from your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's April 6th, 2025, as we record this new episode. The Chicago White Sox had a 3-1 lead heading into the ninth inning on Sunday against the Detroit Tigers, and in very 2024 fashion, gave up three runs to lose 4-3. The White Sox, after starting 2-2 in 2025, have now lost five straight games heading into an off day before embarking to Cleveland for three games against the Guardians. So what gives with the bullpen, and how worried are the White Sox coaches about late inning situations? Our Sox Machine beat reporter James Fegan will join me in a moment to recap the action from Detroit. Also this weekend, Jim Margulis visited the Birmingham Barons to watch their opening weekend, which featured starts from top pitching prospects Noah Schultz and Hagen Smith. We'll learn from Jim how those two looked in their first starts and who else impressed in Birmingham. But at first, on Sunday, USA Today national baseball writer and frequent media megaphone for the Chicago White Sox front office, Bob Nightingale, had in his weekly notes section a tidbit regarding Jerry Reinsdorf and his unwillingness to sell the ball club to billionaire Justin Ishbia, despite all the rumors and speculations. Jerry Reinsdorf insists he'll continue being the chairman as long as he's in good health. Jerry Reinsdorf is 89 years old, not 90, as Nightingale wrote, but that's splitting hairs. Virginia McCaskey lived to be 102. So for those wondering how long Jerry can last, can look into Bears lore. But I want to take a moment to point something out that I found interesting in Sportico when they updated their Major League Baseball valuations. The Chicago Cubs are now worth $5.69 billion. And that's good for fourth most valuable for any club in Major League Baseball. The Cubs generate, on average, $3.25 million in gate revenue per game in 2024. In the regular season, that's a little more than $263 million in just gate revenue. That's not counting any other media deals or sponsorships. Gate revenue is important for Major League Baseball because in 2024, the pendulum swung back to getting fans in the stands by drawing the most dollars. National and local broadcast deals, we know about all the issues with local TV deals now, on average are only worth 44% of a team's revenue. The other 56% are season tickets, suites, parking, concessions, and in-stadium sponsorships. That's why the Cubs saw a 7% in valuation increase with their franchise value. The Ricketts family could make a pretty profit if they sold today. Meanwhile, the White Sox are now valued at $2.03 billion. The Cubs are worth 2.8 times more than the White Sox, despite being in the same market. That's a business problem. And it's even more glaring when you look at the White Sox total revenue generated over the last three seasons. In 2022, they generated $312 million. In 2023, went down to $308 million. Last year, it increased to $317 million. But anyone in business would look at these three totals and say growth is stagnant right now, revenue-wise, for the Chicago White Sox. They've only generated $937 million the last 3 years. Meanwhile, the Cubs have generated $1.635 billion. Last year, only the Athletics, Rays, Pirates, Marlins, and Rockies generated lower revenues than the Chicago White Sox. The White Sox, despite residing in Chicago, the third largest city in the United States, are officially a small market team just based on revenue. That's awful business and should merit a push and change of leadership within any board of any company in any business vertical. But that's the problem with the White Sox. If you think Jerry Reinsdorf's old, he's not even the oldest member on the board. And quite frankly, I'm not even sure the other board members care all that much how the business is doing. If they do, boy, they have a very weird way of showing it. Jerry Reinsdorf holding out because he doesn't have hobbies or he has this fever dream the team will be good again while he's around is enough of a reason to not complete the sell and transition power to Justin Ishbia, because Jerry wants to do right by fans in his way. Well, you won't, Jerry. So I'm not sure what we are doing here by looking at the on-field play and looking at your business earnings. You care greatly one day about bridging the gap between you and the Cubs, and it's not even close. And I don't even think a new ballpark in Project 78 is going to help in that endeavor. The White Sox need to find a way to generate more revenue so they can invest more into building a better on-the-field product. That's the real reason why Jerry Reinsdorf needs to sell today, because it's going to take a couple of years for Justin Ishbia to figure out how to make the White Sox at least a $400 million annual revenue team. That figure would be good for 15th in all of Major League Baseball, which is middle of the pack. Now we wait for the next rumor and gossip to see if we are actually heading towards the light at the end of this tunnel called White Sox fandom. Joining me now is Sox Machine beat reporter James Feegan as he returns home from Detroit. And James, I'm going to try to sound as positive as possible with my tone and pump up fake enthusiasm and excitement. We get to talk about the Major League Baseball team. What a weekend in Detroit. Five-game losing streak. A lot of these losses are looking very similar to last year, especially in the third game when the White Sox blew a 3-1 lead in the ninth inning. How worried are White Sox coaches with the current alignment with the bullpen? Because this seems like a gigantic struggle for them to close out games, and we're only in game 9 of a 162-game season.
My only quibble with the term worried is that it would imply some degree of surprise or like uncertainty. Okay. As opposed to like,
this was expected.
They're worried about it. Like, an inmate who sees their execution date, like nearing. They're not like worried about it. Like, oh, what will the stock market do tomorrow? Type of worry at it. Like they knew that this was like an issue coming in. As I kind of wrote in a story that I guess will be up Monday, like there's really not, like last year the bullpen was like obviously very bad, but like they, you could sound like Michael Kopech to be like, well, this guy could be really good. This is like these tools that we need to convert, or, Brebbia or Tim Hill, even if, we never had a lot of Tim Hill optimism from the way his season started. Hey, they have some guys here who have done it before who we expect like a reasonable like level of effectiveness from. I guess you can make that case for Penn Murphy a little bit, though it's obviously not the longest major league track record. They obviously expected and traded for a kind of baseline performance level from Cam Boozer, who was pretty good for Boston last year, albeit like over 30 rookie and kind of not a full season in the majors, but someone who should be fine. And I think as much as they talk about them not having like a bullpen like leverage really hashed out, like him and Clevinger are kind of like near their top end of guys they trust. But they don't have someone who can just live off their fastball or bully people or even just kind of like get outs with good fastballs when they're behind in the count and things aren't working really well. As many like nights I watched Addison Reed like lose his command or lose his feel for his slider and just try to get people out with fastballs and be like, oh man, why couldn't we ever get this running? At least he could do that. Like if one of these guys, they have a lot of guys where if they get behind and they have to just like kind of power their way out of it, they can't do that. Like that's not really viable for them. I think we saw in the inning like that blew up on Murphy against the Twins on Tuesday, like they were sitting on a slider and he wasn't commanding it great. And that there's not like a big safety valve. Like his changeup is still a work in progress. His 88 mile an hour heater is like deceptively tricky to barrel given like some actions on it, but it's an 88 mile an hour heater. He's not going to spam them to get out of a jam. The sweeper's not working for him. There's not like a big like plan B is not like intriguing for most of these guys. And that's true for like, you know, Frazier Elliott has like a big wide mix of pitches he uses sneakily. Like I think he's like four or five at this point. We had a conversation about it recently about how he's like six pitch. He's five pitches, not six. But it's like a different attack for lefties and righties. It's a similar thing for Jordan Leisure, kind of figuring out what he's going to throw to left-handers, which is why you've seen him and Ellert at the final stages of Sunday's fall apart, like them kind of flip-flopping lefties and righties together. I mean, I can just read out things from Sunday, and it kind of says it says a lot about the team. They used five relievers to try to get seven outs, and they didn't even get the seven outs. Who knows if they actually got farther? Maybe a six would have come out. They have really narrow pockets under which like each one matches up, and so you could see. I think, I hope not every game goes like Sunday, but to some degree, games will go like Sunday in the sense that like Will Venable can leave that guy out here for like the three hitters that they think he can get through, and then once that's end, if it didn't work, he's got to pull the cord, because it's you're not going to stretch these guys out longer than the matchup they work. It's not going to go well. So they have a lot of guys who I think you look at and be like, there's a role for him in a major league bullpen. There's a type of hitter he's effective and useful against. There's a type of, you know, shape he offers that's different from what, you know, we're throwing out there. And it helps, but they don't have these kind of top dogs. They don't have these like high leverage guys. Hopefully some of them emerge at some point. And they've kind of been treating Clevinger and Boozer like they are that. I think Boozer's looked a little bit better than Clevinger, but Boozer's given up two home runs and 20 batters faced. Clevinger's faced 13 guys and walked four of them. And that's really shortened some outings where it seemed like they probably wanted to bring him back out for a second inning if things went well and, you know, his control didn't cooperate. So even where they were kind of thinking they might get some early stability, they haven't really gotten it from. And it's only caused them to cycle through their options even more rapidly in a way that doesn't necessarily look – feels very game three of the 2020 playoffs as you see it play out. So I think Venable like managed it as well as he could on Sunday. Like he wasn't wasting time going down with the ship on anybody on here, but it, you know, it'd be nice if he had a reliever who was worth going down with the ship kind of with. Like, I think when Kopech was pitching at the end of games last year, you kind of felt like, well, they lost fire in their best gun. And I don't think they really even have that kind of luxury right now.
Man, that's going to be tough then, especially one to kind of grade and judge how Venable's doing as a first-time manager. If he is picking the right spots, but the results aren't good, I don't know if that's because of his decision-making. To your point, it could just be the product that's on the field right now. But that also doesn't really pump up a lot of optimism that this 2025 Chicago White Sox team is going to win more games than 2024. If they have a really tough time locking down games, like it's a five-game losing streak, and you can make the argument they should have two wins. They should have beat the Minnesota Twins when they're up 3-0 going into the sixth inning and Shane Smith's start. You're up 3-1 going into the ninth inning against Detroit, and Martin Perez had a great start for the White Sox, and it felt like everything was in place for you. Couldn't knock it down. Couldn't nail it down. So
you're up 3-1, and you just got Kerry Carpenter out to end the eighth, and now you have to face the bottom of the order.
Yeah. So that makes it even worse.
It's going to be like a good and bad year to evaluate Venable, because at least tactically, which is kind of the way you can evaluate managers, because his roster is so a bunch of guys with like small roles, you're going to see him making moves and flipping his attack plan constantly because he literally has to, like every time a new situation arrives.
Okay.
There's very few every down backs on the White Sox roster. But also none of his options are super effective. So it's also a little bit like you grade him on a curve. You're going to see him working a lot, but it's going to be a lot of, it might be a little grading the guy, rearranging the chairs on the Titanic a little bit.
And that's a good point. I just feel like some of the feedback and pushback we're going to get from White Sox fans is that Venable doesn't know what he's doing. He's calling the wrong guy in. And then we're going to be like, no, he is calling the right guy. It's just that guy is not good. And then it's like, well, that's Chris Getz's fault. And then it's like, okay, I don't know where to take this argument anymore. But
point to the right guy. Point to who you think the right guy was.
So
I mean, especially on Sunday, they all went in.
Right. All right. So the White Sox, they have some bullpen blues right now, and they're just going to have to gut it out and figure it out on the fly. I mean, this is really tough for the White Sox right now to try to close out games. The only thing they could really hope for is the offense continues scoring. We'll get to the offensive woes in a moment. Jonathan Cannon, Davis Martin did not go deep in their starts. They got hit around, kind of like Sean Burke did, but for Davis Martin, a lot more in his start. What did Cannon and Martin have to say after their second start of the season?
Cannon, the command isn't as precise as it needs to be for him to really thrive. And that's kind of been an issue since spring. And you kind of wonder where he's at with that, or if he's working through something, could something more be at play? But I think there's also if you want to like clump them together, an overriding theme, they're both kind of dealing with, they've had some success and the book is out on them a little bit. For Cannon, it's this guy wants to get quick outs in the zone. Let's wait him out a lot. Let's run deep counts and see what he has for put away options, because this is not, put away pitch central here. This is a lot of stuff to try to induce weak contact. If you don't think he's going to be able to blow you away, if you think he's trying to get you to just roll over a change, what can we do to draw this guy out? Have foul stuff off, have long at bats, make him inefficient, and also just get to a place where we feel count wise he's going to have to attack us with a fastball that we. There's not a bat missing fastball in that profile, certainly. Maybe if you think are bullish on him getting ground balls to the sinker, he's not. He's another guy who's not built to really power people away. Davis Martin very much was, all right, he's going to throw the kick change a lot. We are going to hunt it. We are going to hunt off speed. It was a fun anecdote. The second start, because Oakland, he learned the start last year when he first threw the kick change. He had learned it the previous day. It was so good, and word spread of it so quickly. Literally the next start, they're facing the Yankees, and Ethan Katz is seeing Aaron Judge in the on-deck circle before facing Martin, and he's doing this exaggerated scoopy motion because he's just trying to – he's already anticipating this kick change and trying to get under it because it has, this bowling ball-like drop movement at the end. And you saw just, all these, his location wasn't great. That curveball he hung to, Kerry Carpenter was kind of put on a platter, but it was a lot of, uppercut swings – on off-speed pitches that were kind of just above the knees, not in awful locations, in the zone, and thus stuff can happen to it. They weren't chase pitches, but not places you hate yourself for putting those type of pitches location wise and they're all geared to do that. So what happens when you're seeing a bunch of uppercut swings at the bottom of the zone? You got to throw a four seamer on top of that to take advantage of what they're doing. That's not Davis's strength. He did start to do it later in that game, and that's how he's unable to get through five. Was just all of a sudden, if you saw the pitch chart at the end, his four seamer wound up being the most used pitch that day. It was barely, it still looks like a Davis Martin start, but it was very heavily kick change and slider and curveball early, and he kind of threw more fastballs to the end. So he wants to make that adjustment a little bit better and be a bit more flexible. And it's not like he doesn't have a fastball, and if you're just truly selling out for off speed, his fastball will work on you. But it does speak to other teams are going to try to take. If you have these guys who I don't want to say are one dimensional, but clearly have a preference of the way they want to pitch. Now that they've done that a little bit and shown they can do that at major league caliber level, now they're going to face the level of teams are going to try to take away your ideal want to pitch. How good is your kind of plan B route going to be? And I think with relievers, it's probably a bit more throw your hands up, bring in the next one. With starters, you've got to be able to win games different ways. That's the burden of being a starter. So I think we're going to see them showing that, they can bust out that four seamer a bit, even if that's not their way of pitching when, opposing teams are really selling out to take away their plan A, because, hey, it's a compliment. your plan A is good enough for teams to plan around it. Now you kind of have to be very comfortable with your adjustments and like a little bit quicker than they were in the Martin start.
Andrew Benintendi left Sunday's game early. What's the injury status for Benintendi, James?
They called him day to day, which doesn't tell us much. But I thought it was interesting that Venable really felt he actually injured it, slamming to the wall for the catch he made, I want to say, in the Davis Martin start on Saturday, and essentially was going to play through it, and it flared up on Sunday. So I think that would make me a little bit more optimistic about it. It's certainly not the most convenient time to have DFA'd your reserve lefty outfielder in anticipation of having your full healthy set, but the fact that it didn't initially put him to the IL, I think would be a positive. And obviously, if, you know, running around the outfield was the original instigator of it, and maybe a way we get around it is just DHing him for a while. I know a certain well-regarded podcast host who would view that as a big strategic strategy or tragedy. neither a big strategic strategy nor tragedy. So we'll have to see. They did just clear a 40-man spot, so they can, like, it could be Dom Fletcher hours to fill the gap if he has a 10-day stint in him. But it was something that he was originally playing through, which suggests that maybe he can continue playing through it, especially with an off day to kind of rest it. And, you know, the option certainly with this roster to just DH him through it a little bit. It seemed like I got aggravated on a kind of unusually strenuous ordeal around the bases. It did see him score. You saw him really kind of look most uncomfortable as he was scoring from third on that sac fly. And he already had to go back and forth because of that throwing error that Margot had earlier in that sequence. So if he's just circling the bases, maybe he's fine. It's a weird way to talk about Andrew Benintendi, but that is kind of his role on this team a little bit. It's just the designated power hitter, you know, your classic, you know, 5'9" power hitting DH. Stranger things have happened. So hoping for the best for him. It seemed like it's at least they're talking about it like minor, other than the part where he came out of the game, which Andrew Benintendi will usually tell you is a sign that things are kind of bad if he's coming out of the game.
Mike Tauchman made his season debut with the White Sox. He ended up going 1-for-3 with a walk and a strikeout. He made a couple catches in foul territory for the White Sox as well, playing right field. How did Tauchman look to you, James, in the stadium?
He looked like the genuine Mike Tauchman article. 1-for-3 with a single and a walk, a lot of long at bats. It's funny because, like, he'll, you know, you make this assumption like, oh, you like taking pictures, you take pride in working counts, you're always a leadoff guy, right? And he's like, no, I'm up there, I'm trying to swing at a good pitch. Like, if I get a good pitch to hit on pitch one, I'll jump on it. Like, I'm not just trying to work the count. That's not the way I hit. That's not the way I approach things. I'm trying to drive the ball like everyone else. And then you watch him and just like, everything's 7 pitches long, man. I don't know what to tell you. I don't know how this keeps happening to you. But yeah, I think he's, you know, a very useful hitter, extending the lineup. You know, even if this wasn't like a young team, this is a team where like they're not doing tons of damage. So if they can at least make the pitcher work hard, that's some positive for them. So I think Tauchman provides that. He caught on base twice. There wasn't like a big power hit, but getting on base twice, causing some action, playing pretty good defense for a corner. This is what we were sold. This is what he did in his first game. So promises made, promises kept. It's a long season. He has to stay healthy. He's 34. Anything that hints decline will probably make us panic for an episode or two. But he looked like Mike Tauchman. It looked like they signed Mike Tauchman on the free agent market and got Mike Tauchman. So credit to them. You always like to open the package and see the thing you actually bought.
Well, so far the White Sox are averaging 3.55 runs per game after 9 games. They're on pace to score 576 runs for those invested in the season-long steak dinner bet for how many runs the White Sox will score this year. But James, in one of your game recaps over the weekend from Detroit, you mentioned we are noticing a trend. So other than the the White Sox bullpen issues and how they're going to have to circumvent late innings in upcoming games. Against right-handed pitching, the White Sox as a team have a 636 OPS. Now, that's not last in Major League Baseball. That might surprise some of you. That's 23rd in Major League Baseball, but that's still not a good mark for the White Sox. And there are three hitters in particular really struggling against right-handers. Luis Robert is 3-for-27 against right-handed pitching to start the year. He's already got 10 strikeouts. He does have four walks, but it's a 330 OPS against right-handed pitchers for Robert. Vargas is also 3-for-27. He's got 8 strikeouts to 5 walks against right-handed pitching. And Andrew Vaughn's 5-for-27. He's got at least a home run off of a right-handed pitcher, but that's 6 strikeouts and 1 walk for Vaughn against right-handed pitchers this year. His OPS is 584. These guys are assuming to be your middle of the order here for the White Sox offense, James. And Robert, Vargas, and Vaughn are already struggling greatly against right-handed pitching. We know about the struggles from Vargas last year, just overall. I have documented the struggles and the weak points for Andrew Vaughn against right-handed pitching, especially on the breakers. But White Sox fans are starting to sweat about Luis Robert. What are you hearing from White Sox coaches about Robert? And is there merit behind the concern despite it only being 9 games so far?
In the sense of, like, I think from a fan perspective or just like my analyst perspective, there's not actually like a super consistent track record of like it all coming together. There's been like years where he's hit for big average, some years he hit for like big time power. There's been a lot of years where he's like, you know, had a hot streak and then been bad for a long cold streak, or he's been hurt and there's been some up to speed stuff. It's not a fall out of bed and hit profile. So any cold streak like he's going on, you kind of wonder like, well, when's he going to come out of it? How long will it take? What will his numbers look like by July? Will he kind of demonstrate what he can be at a rate that, you know, is aesthetically pleasing and boosts his value? And I think there's uncertainty there. I think from talking to coaches or just like their general like view of him, it's like, well, we know he can impact the baseball. We know he has bat speed. You know, we saw him look really good at the end of spring. Yeah, the results haven't been there, but, you know, we've seen, you know, hard lineouts didn't go his way. We really like that he's taking pitches and taking walks. He's doing this at a level we've never done before. We always thought like this was the one breakthrough he had if he just like got like a grade better at like plate discipline or not chasing at all. Like, it's a superstar. Our view is probably lower to glint from there. We'd like just like solid above average regular. You know, a 4-win season, I think, would do everyone mentally a great. I don't think we need to like have the Luis Robert, is he an MVP caliber player discussion again to feel like, okay, they got him rolling and now they can get something for him. So I think his profile invites a little uncertainty. I think from as far as viewing from a coaching standpoint of just like, it's 9 games, be like, hey, he's taking pitches, he'll probably be fine. It's very cold. You know, he's had some balls that might carry that were in the first 2 series in Chicago in warmer situations. He's still healthy. It'll probably be all right at some point. I don't think major alarm bells are off, other than maybe just the general streakiness of why you're no longer thinking like, this is our franchise centerpiece and cornerstone and we'll hold on to him through the rebuild, however long it might be, because he's just so good. I think some of that mercurialness in his performance is in there right now. But I don't think like it's what's wrong with him. Is he broken? Does he need to go on the IL? Does he need a hit doctor? He just seems like a slow start to me, but with some things to be encouraged by. Did you ask about Vaughn, or was I just talking
about him? No, I did not ask about Vaughn. It's okay. We don't have to talk about Vaughn's issues against right-handed pitching.
He looks hitterish. The only thing is, like, you look up and, oh, he hasn't, like, had much luck in terms of actually lifting it. And then you look in the part where it's like, oh, 0 walks? Oh. well, that's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, he did have an RBI single today, and he had the RBI double in the previous game. So he's coming around. He's hitting the ball hard.
Yeah, like, in general, he looks like he's having decent at-bats. It's just distressing knowing that that's going to wax and wane and whatever, or he's going to go through issues where he's not lifting the ball, that he's not providing himself that baseline of production that we thought plus plate discipline coming out of college is going to give him. That he kind of has to ride the highs and lows of the hot streaks, because it's all just like striking the ball is where his value is. That there's not this at bat quality, that baseline that was supposed to make him a safer right first baseman pick than we hoped.
I just don't know if opposing pitchers are afraid of him. So we'll see. We'll see how the next couple of weeks go. But again, for the White Sox, struggles offensively to start the season. If you got Robert, Vargas, and Vaughn in the middle of your order, and the opposing team's got a right-handed starter, these guys are struggling coming out of the gate. So that's why, part of the reason why the offense is sputtering. Another problem for the White Sox offense: runners in scoring position. They have a team OPS of 669. They're batting just 189 with runners in scoring position. Now, note, in Major League Baseball, half of the teams to start the year have an OPS below 700 with runners in scoring position. So the White Sox are not the only team that's struggling right now to hit with runners in scoring position. A lot of teams are. The only team that's not seems to be the New York Yankees, who have a team OPS over 1,000 with runners in scoring position. The St. Louis Cardinals, I think, are batting over 300 as a team with runners in scoring position right now. It's just a matter of, can the White Sox improve upon this when they do get those opportunities? Because they don't get many opportunities, as we have seen so far to start the year. The game is finding Andrew Benintendi. He's 2-for-9 with runners in scoring position. Both of those hits have been home runs. Andrew Vaughn has been effective with runners in scoring position. He's 3-for-7 with the home run. But Robert's 0-for-6. He's still searching for his first hit with runners in scoring position. Brooks Baldwin's got a few RBIs, but he's 1-for-5. And Miguel Vargas is 1-for-5, but he has 3 walks, and he's not struck out yet with runners in scoring position. So kind of odd for the White Sox offense. But again, they get swept by Detroit. We were hoping that they'd play better against the American League Central. But right now, the 2-7 White Sox are now 1-5 against the American League Central after losing 2 of 3 against the Minnesota Twins and getting swept by the Detroit Tigers. They have lost 5 straight games as they have the day off on Monday, but they'll be making their way to Cleveland, Ohio, as the Guardians have their home opener on Tuesday. Cleveland, not a great start for them. They are 3-6, but all 9 games were on the road. They lost their last 2 games against the Angels. And your pitching problems for this series, Tuesday afternoon, this is the Guardians home opener. This is going to be a first pitch at 3:10 p.m. Central Time. Shane Smith will get his second start for the White Sox against right-handed pitcher Ben Lively. Wednesday night, 5:10 p.m. Central Time, this is going to be another Sox Machine from the 108 playback watch party. So thank you to so many people who did watch with us for Saturday's game. We'll have that for you guys on Wednesday night at playback.tv/Sox Machine. That will be Sean Burke making his third start of the season against left-handed pitcher Logan Allen. And then Thursday, getaway day for the White Sox, 12:10 p.m. Central Time. So you may have to watch or listen on the radio at work. Jonathan Cannon against Gavin Williams. James, Shane Smith, second start. What kind of adjustments are the White Sox expecting to see from Smith?
I mean, I don't know if like they view it as like he kind of like looked pretty good and then ran out of gas a bit. So as far as like, I think the big thing is like stamina, both in terms of like command, obviously. Like he hadn't gone 6 ups before, I think, in spring, but it was a pretty low pitch count. But it's also just a guy who hasn't like thrown or started like a ton in terms of accumulating their workload. So seeing how like the velocity holds, I think is big. I was talking to Shane a little bit this weekend about his fastball, and Brian Bannister described how like some of them cut and some of them kind of stay true, and he kind of sold it as the randomization is like difficult for hitters to deal with. And when I got laid off by the Athletic in 2023, I wound up covering the Cubs a lot that year, And Justin Steele was like very interesting because he's this guy who like has this cut ride fastball, and it'll cut kind of more at times, and it'll ride more in times, and he kind of has control of it a little bit. It's kind of like intent. Like when he's kind of intending to get inside on a lefty, he'll see it cut a little bit more. Or I'm thinking the wrong orientation. Trying to get on a righty, he'll see it cut a little bit more. If he's trying to go up top, he'll see it ride a bit more. Shane is not at that level yet with it. He's kind of more, I'm learning the situations where it does cut, and I'm learning the situations where it does ride. And if I kind of know when it does, I can kind of pick and choose. He can't necessarily like make it behave a certain way, but he can maybe predict it, and thus, trying to see if that leads, if that's something. It feels like it'd be a very gradual process, not like one start and he's good. But I'm wondering, like, do we see kind of the fastball command tick up as he kind of, because this he really kind of started only embracing the way his fastball works. He was trying to fight it and just throw a traditional rider up until like the last, few weeks of last season. So is that something we see him kind of build off of? I've been watching him a lot because Eric Longenhagen with Fangraphs, we're doing the White Sox prospect list right now. And Eric really likes Shane Smith. Probably going to put him in an updated top 100. But it's a lot of tools that he throws out there to like, well, that pitch looks really good. Well, that look pitch looks really good. But not necessarily seeing everything work in tandem. Like he's kind of got a curveball that like the action on it's like he got some swing and misses on it. It really doesn't look like any other pitch in his arsenal right now. Like he should probably be able to recognize his curveball because like it's just going over the top when everything else is like darting to the side in like hard and fast ways. His slider looks really good visually, and the idea of kind of throwing a gyro slider off a cutting fastball, you'd think it really would look like the cutting fastball all the way into the last second. But he didn't get like tons of chase on it against Minnesota, so trying to see if that will play up. That was something he talked about working on in spring. And just a changeup is like it's just not a pitch he's been throwing for that long. So I think everything was kind of in the general area of what he wants it to be, but I think I ideally it's a pitch you see him kind of grow a command of. I had one scout joke like if he can throw in the zone, it's deadly because it's kind of a pitch like you could tell him it's coming and they can't hit it. Like it's 92, it just falls off the table like a splitter. The only real solace you have is if he's just throwing everything like below the knees and like if you can recognize it at all, you just know to lay off of it because you'll never hit it. And something Rocco Baldelli spoke post game, and I think I referenced this the last episode from the Twins, saying like he was really impressed with Smith, but like eventually they got to the point where like, hey, it's the third time through, we're not barreling him. Let's just like wait him out. Let's like be super patient, make him throw strikes, and that's how kind of that sixth inning blew up. Obviously, he's at the very end of his outing, maybe it doesn't work as well, but seeing a little bit like, do we see more patience from opposing teams? Is he just facing the Guardians for the first time and he's just going to stop them because he has the changeup and they've never seen it? How's it going to go? I think there's a lot of possibilities at this early portion of his career. When you have kind of a young starter emerge for the first time, and I feel like I'm going to become an old guy who just references Lucas Giolito constantly, but like that first season when he was good and he had that changeup, he had so many starts where he just threw two pitches because like no one had seen him before or seen him work in this way before. It's just like we got nothing here, and it is only until like subsequent years where you see him have to use a slider more as people adjust to him. So, are we going to get this run of Shane Smith kind of running over some teams if he has everything working? Because just no one's familiar. Like the changeup, it's not even a kick change. It's really like not a breed of changeup, both on the way he throws it or its movement profile that you're really seeing. So, does he just like kind of have a monster first half because this unicorn pitch? Does he have command issues because he hasn't started a whole ton? I feel like anything could happen in a Shane Smith start, so it's kind of a reason to watch, especially for a White Sox team where you feel like you're in the version, the part of Groundhog Day where Bill Murray is trying to jump off buildings all the time with this team. Shane Smith's kind of anything is possible sort of outing right now.
Well, again, Shane Smith will be making that start on Tuesday afternoon. That's a 3:10 p.m. Central Time start. Again, Sean Burke will be starting during the Sox Machine Playback Watch Party at 5:10 p.m. on Wednesday night. And hopefully things go better for the White Sox in Cleveland. We'll see how Will Venable handles high leverage situations, especially with Jose Ramirez at the plate. As we've known for many years, that's been a tough point, a sore spot for White Sox fans watching games against the Guardians. And as we wrap up with James here, as we will do every week, because I'm so invested in how his fantasy baseball team is doing, how'd you close out week two, James? Did you earn another W?
We won by, 65 points. I wasn't even really looking at it in terms of like, oh, are we going to win or not? Just making sure like, are things optimized as we are? Do we want to keep riding the Ronel Blanco roller coaster this season? It did behave well for us last year, but I don't know. We didn't even pitch that well this week. We spent a lot of draft capital on pitching going forward because I didn't feel great about our stores, but just banged the baseball this week. Logan Ohapi, it's a league. It's like, I want to say it's 12-team league, but you have to start two catchers. It's hard to have that many good offensive catchers. Why my colleagues haven't invested like I have, where I just, trot out Patrick Graley and Logan Ohapi, and now we'll get Sean Murphy off the IL any minute. I don't know why I'm, blessed with this sort of foresight, but he did well. I begrudgingly acknowledge, as much as he's let me down so many times, just a ghost, someone I don't even count being around on playoff time. A healthy Mike Trout is indeed a productive fantasy player. so I guess I'm glad I didn't like rage trade him at any point in the last 3 years, at least right now. Nico Hoerner stole 6 bags this week. Good for him.
That's crazy.
He threw something that looked like a gyro slider on the double play turn to Justin Turner on Sunday, but that doesn't really affect me so much. So sky high approval rating for me on Nico Hoerner. undefeated, unchallenged, really. Looking forward to cruising to another number one seed that I spurn in the playoffs. Jorge Polanco has been a great waiver wire pickup. Just like, I wish I could miss just to know what it feels like, really.
Well, the Bridgeport Corgis and the Sox Machine 32 team fantasy league, we're going to finally win. We're up 8-2 as we record this, beating the Pawnee Parks Department. So the Bridgeport Corgis going to move to 1-1. Want to thank my offense for finally hitting home runs. Jake Berger, still a fan. Cal Raleigh finally hitting some home runs for me. We all hope that your fantasy baseball teams are doing well. We'll check in on the 32-team Sox Machine Fantasy Baseball League every week to see how that is going. And there's other fantasy leagues as well that feed into the 32-team league now. So that is something that you're interested in next season. Definitely be a Sox Machine subscriber so we can get you guys involved in the various fantasy leagues that we have in Sox Machine for baseball. But that will do it for this segment with James Fegan. James, I hope visiting Detroit again was a fun experience. It doesn't sound like you did any feather bowling this time, but thank you so much for your reports this weekend from Detroit.
Thanks for sending me. I had fun looking at Canada, just eyeing it, not like, no plan involved, just looking, observing from my hotel room across the river.
We shift gears in the Sox Machine podcast as the White Sox minor league affiliates are now all on their way to start the 2025 season. Charlotte started around Major League Baseball opening day, but Birmingham, Winston-Salem, and Kannapolis started their seasons this past weekend. Lucky to have the managing editor of SoxMachine.com, Jim Margulis, visit Birmingham as the Barons start their defense of their 2024 Southern League Championship. In large thanks to Sox Machine subscribers. So again, thank you for your continued support. And Jim, how was Birmingham?
It was great. It was nice to see baseball live again. It's always nice to drop down and see old friends and new friends in the organization. Great catching up with Jonathan Nelson. Also met Doug, the Kurt Bloom replacement in the broadcast booth. It was nice to see that the Barons replaced Kurt, who had been there for 33 years, I believe, with another veteran voice. I'm trying to remember his last name. I'll make sure I get it right when it comes to Doug's last name. But he was a play-by-play guy for Fresno for a number of years. And then when Fresno went to A-ball, they were AAA for the longest time, then went to A-ball as part of the reorganization. And not quite the same when it comes to drawing power, when it comes to prestige and everything like that. So looking for another opportunity. This one opened up, and it was great meeting him.
Awesome. So the Barons split the two games. Sunday was rained out, as that typically happens in April in Birmingham, Alabama. What are your first impressions of the new coaching staff for the Barons? Because Sergio Santos got promoted from Birmingham, and now he's running the Charlotte Knights. So who is part of the Barons coaching staff, Jim?
It's Doug Greenwald, by the way, is new broadcaster. I knew it was Green something, but I needed to get the last part right. So Doug Greenwald is the new Kurt Bloom. Very nice guy. When it comes to new coaching staff, you know, it was funny talking to John Eli last year over the course of a number of years, very effusive guy. Isn't quite another John Eli in the group right now in terms of nobody immediately ready to talk your ear off. So it's a case of, miss him a little bit. That was always fun to chat with him. But, brand new season, especially the pitchers, really high expectations, a lot of questions when it comes to how are you going to handle Noah Schultz? How are you going to handle Hagen Smith, Grant Taylor? And, they sounded ready for him. They have plans in place for each. And that's mainly the focus at this point, the position player side, a little bit thinner. So it will be a pitch and driven roster. And that's kind of how it went with the first couple of games with the Barons, is that the offense, a little lopsided, kind of lacking in power bats. And also, given that's April, wind blowing in, ball not really caring, wasn't so much of a big ballpark, more of a small ball game. And, Noah Schultz certainly got tested in that regard.
Yeah, so let's talk about the White Sox pitchers. You saw Noah Schultz, you saw Hagen Smith. So let's start with Noah Schultz. As he went four innings, he allowed 8 hits, 4 earned runs. He only walked one, though, while striking out 5. How did Schultz look? Was this like death by 1,000 paper cuts type of scenario for Schultz?
It was. I was talking to new pitching coach John Kovalik after Schultz's start, and he basically got peppered to opposite field, middle of the field, line drives, grounders through. And, he's faced now, they were the Tennessee Smokies, now they're the Knoxville Smokies, but he's faced the Smokies in one name or another like 6 times over the last 3 months. So it's a case of the Southern League being pretty small and having a book on him more than they would on other pitchers, or if you were pitching in the major leagues, he would not face the Kansas City Royals as much as he faces the Knoxville Smokies. So there's a little bit of familiarity there. And basically he didn't have a slider. So they were targeting the fastball. And that's one thing Kovalik said, was that he got a little, sinker heavy, and they weren't in a position where they had a chase slider. So I think from what I could see, they're basically looking for fastballs away and poking them to right field. And they did pretty well, at least for a couple innings, stacking the deck. And then when Schultz tried to change his plan, I think he buried a slider in, hit a guy, walked a couple. And it took until finally, I think, getting the ears in his cutter that he was able to get off his fastball. And then the contact became a lot more weak. They're starting to roll balls over, and he found it. And I think that's the, that's one advantage, I think, of the Smokies having a more contact oriented lineup, is that they weren't looking to pull him. And so they didn't get in trouble by trying to, take pitches that were reliably out or half and trying to take them to left field. I think the other thing that's funny about Schultz is, this is my 5th time watching him, and this is like the closest that I saw him getting knocked out of the game. Like, I've never seen him getting like pummeled. I've seen him, have to finish fewer than 4 innings because of pitch count, but he's never really gotten like knocked out of a game. And this is the closest I saw, but even then it was all singles. And so I think that's really, while he has some development to do in terms of, finding a good mix to, generate less contact. I think the slider is a great pitch for that, but I think he's still working on the high fastball. He was throwing a seam effects changeup that he's working in more. And I think that those will be like the two pitches he'll use that's not his slider to get swings and misses or pop-ups or other otherwise useless contact. But even when he's not getting that, he's still a hard guy to square up. I think he's so unusual, 6'10" and just throwing from like the short stride, like three quarters or lower delivery, that even the contact, like when it's solid, and it was solid contact, it wasn't, they weren't like rockets. They were just like useful line drives to right field or center field. And he gave up three runs in one inning, partially because Omar Narvaez dropped a pretty good throw from Oscar Colas that, yeah, that would have cut down a run on a single. A second run was scored, bad send. Throw beat him in plenty of time, but Narvaez dropped the ball. Then again, that's something that if Schultz is called up, he'll have to get used to when it comes to the White Sox defense, botching some things. But it wasn't a case where, the outfielders were turning around and just, retrieving balls the gap. They're all just like well-placed singles that he couldn't do anything with. And that's something I think when he, on a night where he has a better slider, or as he gets used to moving the fastball around, or, if he gets more comfortable with the changeup, when he's having nights like that where the fastball is getting poked and, the slider isn't quite there, he'll have other ways to go about his business to generate weaker or less contact.
And in game two, you got a chance to see Hagen Smith. He also went four innings, hitless innings. He only allowed one earned run. He did hit a batter. He walked four, but struck out 10, and you are texting us that Smith was really struggling early in that start with his control, Jim, and struggling to hold runners on. He finally found a groove late. So give us your report on Hagen Smith in his first start at AA.
Yeah, first two innings were a mess. Second two innings were as easy as you'll see from a minor league pitcher. So I'm glad I saw that, because it was pretty unelectric, I would say, for the first two innings. Just seemed like he was fighting himself, bouncing pitch. Yeah, almost like he couldn't find his release point. Missing high, missing wide, and then missing in and missing low. Just overcompensating, going back and forth. Just like Schultz, talented enough to where, he might have put himself on the ropes with walks and hit batters, but didn't give up the big blow to open the floodgates, just because the stuff is still lively enough. I think he's mostly sitting like 93, got 94, 95, or at least I think rounding up to 95 a handful of times, but mostly in the 93, 94 zone. And so that wasn't all that impressive when you look at like the velocity that Schultz is throwing, which is like 97, a couple 98s in there. His arm looked fresh. That was the case of like, man, this is not like a fifth overall pick you're watching. And then he gave one easy stolen base and like a couple of huge jumps that were foul balls. And that's something we saw in spring training. Maybe a guy who's just not used to holding runners because he didn't, have that many and, got a ton of strikeouts. So, there was that for the first two innings. And then found it. Yeah. The breaking ball, two breaking balls, the slower one, 78, dropping in for strikes a second time. He started off a batter with that, and then that worked. Did it again. Frozen, no response again. And then, I think it was a three-pitch strikeout. Then slow, slow, fast. And then the slider was getting really silly misses. That was the breaking ball that he got drafted on. And it showed up, and he struck out the last six batters he faced, 10 overall. I'm glad that he wasn't under the constraints he was last year throwing three innings, because I would have missed that. And that was a lot of fun to see from behind home plate.
Yeah, I just wonder moving forward if that's something that he's going to have to battle. Is it's okay to live more in the zone, and you're not going to be perfect right away. Because when you were sharing how the first two innings went, it was very unlike the Hagen Smith that I saw at Arkansas last year. But at the same time, he did have a 10% walk rate in college, which is pretty high, especially compared to some of the starting pitchers that I'm seeing this upcoming draft class for this upcoming season. So maybe walks will be an issue. I know Eric Loggenhagen of Fangraphs said that's one of his concerns with Hagen Smith. So something to watch moving forward, Sox Machine listeners and readers, is how is Hagen Smith handling as far as the walks? His stuff is good enough at Double A to rack up 10 strikeouts easily, like you mentioned, Jim. Like that's my expectation.
I think he wasn't so much nibbling as it was just not having it right away. And a little bit of frustration, hides it pretty well, though, in terms of I think he had a wild pitch on a ball three where the run came home and, you know, walked better, but also allowed a run to come in. You could see a little bit of like a glove snap and then, you know, coming off the mound, a little bit of, you know, cursing into his glove as he's walking off. And I did watch him go into the dugout, nothing thrown, no slams, no frustration vented. So he did seem like he wasn't too worried about it or too worked up. And then, yeah, as soon as it clicked, it was very simple for him.
Again, I mean, it's a pretty impressive stat line for four innings. To strike out 10 batters in four innings is pretty impressive. So a little nitpicking, but something to watch is his control.
But I think, you know, having them pitch back to back was instructive because I think that's if Schultz had his slider, you know, his start might have looked more like that because they could not touch it when it was double A hitters like, you know, reversing Schultz's fastball. Oh, that's pretty impressive. He's got nothing. But yeah, if he had that weapon that he normally counts on, it would have been a lot simpler for him. And I think, you know, Smith was a little bit like, here's how it should have looked when he was throwing his third and fourth innings for how simple it was. And so I'm curious, you know, as the season goes along, will they pitch back to back? Will you see that more of just, you know, almost like Smith is drafting off him a little bit in the back? Like, here's the game plan. See if you execute it. If so, I'll follow it. If not, we'll try it again and see how it works. It's almost kind of a little bit cool in that regard.
Well, I mean, for Birmingham, it'd be great, especially when they have home series Friday, Saturday night. Get the crowd in, get a chance to watch Noah Schultz, Hagen Smith. That'll draw some fans. And based on the things that you are posting, pictures and video on our Instagram channel, which you can follow us on Instagram at Sox Machine, it looked like a lively crowd in Birmingham, Jim.
Yeah, opening day drew pretty well. I think it was 5,200, 5,300, something in that range. But
that's good.
Loud. It's good, but also like, loud, locked in. The big inning where Jacob Gonzalez hit the bases clearing triple to put the Barons ahead, it was a series of walks and long at bats. And, you know, as the inning built, and that's not something you're used to seeing when it comes to the White Sox, you know, at the major league level, a sequence of strong plate appearances, long at bats, drawing walks. You could hear like, you know, when balls are fouled off and, you know, at bats are extending 6-7 pitches for the third consecutive batter, that the crowd is getting into it. Like a lot of the good minor league crowd, you know, you get a little, you know, like a lot of little league chatter in the crowd. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. Like you hear guys telling professional hitters, like, you know, what are you taking that for? Get the bat off your shoulder. You know, almost like hearing a third base coach in little league saying, come on, a little bingo, etc. But this was the crowd, you know, just like, good, come on, Jacob. Yeah, good swing. Way to fight. You know, like it was the good kind of encouragement that you like hearing in a family friendly environment. You know, positive role models in the crowd for watching baseball and you know, rooting for the right things rather than heckling guys who are making $30,000 a year, which is the less savory part of it. But it was a great crowd. And as soon as Gonzalez hit that triple off the bat and you got past the diving attempt in center field, crowd went nuts. Stayed through the game. Fireworks after. I mean, that's the kind of entertainment that you sign up for when you you pay what, 12, 15 bucks per ticket to show up to a game on a Friday night. Parking's free. I mean, that's kind of what you want when you're taking the family out.
That sounds like a better deal than going to a White Sox game. For the Barons, two old friends, I guess, in a way. Omar Narváez and Oscar Colas, they're currently playing with the Barons. Was it weird to see them in Double-A, Jim?
Colas, no, just because he's been in the minors for a while. So, like, I've seen him at various cities in various uniforms and just like, oh, there's Oscar Colas again. Narváez, yes. And, you know, we make fun of the White Sox for releasing their rosters 5 minutes before first pitch, you know, as we try to plan season previews around what they're doing. The Kannapolis Cannonballers and Winston-Salem Dash were well ahead, like days ahead in announcing their rosters, But the rosters that they released on social media did not match the rosters on their website. You know, when I was like double checking to make sure this is funny, you know, good if anything was weird. And that's because of Narvaez. Like, Narvaez was the reason why the Birmingham's roster didn't come out early, because I guess they're, you know, waiting to see if he's going to show up and where he's going to report, because there's no room at the inn in Charlotte with Teal and Caro there. So I guess they got him down to double A. But I didn't learn about it until I showed up to Regions Field, went to the press box, grabbed a, you know, roster and lineup sheet, and I was like, huh, Omar Narvaez. And looked on, you know, that was matched. And then all of a sudden, like, the other rosters, the minor league affiliates, because the one thing I was judging was, is Birmingham roster updated? And what I was judging was Matt Hogan, outfielder, was on Birmingham's roster, listed online, but he was also listed in Winston-Salem's press release, or the social media updated roster. So it's like, until Matt Hogan moves, I do not trust this roster. And once I got to Birmingham, saw the roster, went online, saw Matt Hogan was no longer on Birmingham's roster. It's like, okay, this is actually real and official and everything else is in place. But Narvaez was the reason why. And when I talked to Guillermo Quiroz, who's the Winston-Salem manager, about, he's just like, yeah, don't know how it happened, but we're happy to have him. You know, he likes having an extra veteran catcher around. Talking to Quiroz and Kovalik about just having a, you know, such an experienced catcher back there. He's like, yeah, you can, you know, he has the ability to see stuff that, you know, either we might be seeing at the same time, might be seeing slightly ahead, but either way, probably seeing it ahead of where a traditional 22 to 24 year old double A catcher might be seeing it. So yeah, they're happy to have him for as long as they have him.
Now, for the rest of the roster and all the players that you got the chance to see for the Barons, let's start with who impressed you the most this weekend.
Hitting wise was kind of quiet. Wilfred Veras still drawing walks, which is something that he started doing late last year. And, you know, it's hard to know when it's late last year and he's playing his second full season in Birmingham. First full season in Birmingham, but, you know, second significant go around. And, you know, he starts drawing walks at the time where rosters are changing and pitchers are getting promoted from high A's. The case where, you know, he's more experienced and he's drawing walks from less experienced pitchers who are wilder and learning double A's, are actually developing himself. So I was curious watching him start this season if that continues. And yeah, he's still drawing walks. So that's, you know, a useful skill for him. On the pitching side, you know, watching the relievers go through, and, you know, it's a case early in the season, every reliever is new, getting reps. You know, nobody's pitching on back-to-back days. Peyton Paulette closed out an inning with ease. So he was the closer for opening night. I imagine, you know, if he's not pitching back-to-back days, he will be the closer, like, by default. But he closed on opening night with ease. Tyler Davis closed, or attempted closing, in game two, blew the save, did not go so well. So you kind of saw your studies in contrast there. But yeah, bullpen on the first night looked great. Like, Gil Luna was somebody who, if you watch him pitch at a game at a time, sometimes is really impressive. You know, he's got a pretty lively fastball, you know, 94, 95 from the left side. Occasionally some breaking balls look really good, but then you look at some other games, you know, walks three batters in a game. I think he ended up walking like 48 and 46 innings last year. Was able to mitigate that because of a really good pickoff move. So that's a case of, he is able to erase some of the walks he issues, but still more than a batter an inning is a problem. And he struck out the side on 12 pitches, which is what you want to see. He's just, and he's one of those guys who has a really big victory lap around the mound. It you know, when he gets strike three, he starts walking like halfway at the shortstop and then cuts it off and starts walking to first base. I always enjoy like the real, you know, the, just the emphatic strut. And then you got the third strikeout and did the pirouette in the mound, spinning off and back to the dugout. And so it's fun to see him. Like, when it clicks, it's good. It just, you know, it never seems to click for long. So I will be curious watching him after first game. Has anything changed, or is it a case where he's going to walk the bases loaded his next time out, and all of a sudden he's walked through batters in two innings and he's back to where he was? But very good first impression.
So who's interesting enough to merit Sox Machine readers and listeners their attention when they read your minor keys almost every day on SoxMachine.com?
Well, you have the starting rotation, and it's Grant Taylor is not pitching till Wednesday, so Gowans was going to be the starter. The game was rained out, rain all day in Birmingham, but he would be starting on Sunday. I was interested to see, like, since they're saying they're going to start Wickham and Gonzalez, and they had Taylor and Smith and Schultz already in the rotation, and then they have Gowans, and then they have Tyler Schweitzer. I was curious who was going to be the odd man out. Turns out it's Schweitzer, but only in terms of starting. He's going to be backing up Grant Taylor, who's going to be limited to three innings. He's going to be pitching every five games. So it's like the Noah Schultz plan in terms of like a fixed innings limit, but not Noah Schultz like in terms of pitching only one day a week. He will be pitching every five games, but he's going to leave six innings for Schweitzer. And Schweitzer reliably went 5 to 6 innings when he started. So on that night, you know, if all is going well and they're not like trying to play matchups at the end of the game, you could see that the Barons only used two pitchers in that night. So it's a pretty nice problem for the Barons to have, where one guy is not getting the starts he might deserve, but should be still getting the innings. So we'll see if that shifts at all. But I think that's a nice little nod to Gowans, who was kind of sneaky good last year as the least recognizable player in that Aaron Bummer package, coming over and having a nice year in high A and double A. So let's see if he keeps going, because he's the last one left. I mean, Jared Schuster's around, but in terms of guys, the White Sox might be hoping for some kind of impact versus like somebody who can be just pushed and pulled off the 26 man roster when they need a long man. Gowans is the last hope there. So that's interesting. The other thing I'm kind of wondering is Riku Nishida was not in the starting lineup in the first two games. And he came in as a pinch runner and he had a really nice year last year. He's a fan favorite, you know, for all the fan favorite reasons in terms of like fun as hell to watch. Like when he gets on base, plays a lot of charisma and everything like that. But he is very small. It's funny watching him in the lineup at first base for the national anthem, and he's standing next to Noah Schultz. So you have 5'6" standing against 6'10". That's one of those cases where it looks like, you know, Schultz took his kid to work when he's standing. Yeah, when there's that big of a contrast. But you know, him and William Bregoia, and Bregoia is another guy, he's 5'9", but two guys who are not very physical, in terms of when they stand in the box and when you see him swing, like not a lot of power behind that swing. Bregoia is getting starts at shortstop. So, you know, that's, and he had a really nice spring, got a lot of reps with the big league club where they're figuring out their shortstop stuff, but watching Bregoia struck out, three times, last game I saw him, and just a swing where, you know, if he is starts striking out against double A pitching, there's not a lot there in terms of, power to make up for it. So I'm watching that middle infield mix, because if, you know, Bregoia struggles, you know, you could maybe see Nishida come in. Yeah, it sounds like Nishida is going to be getting more outfield reps this year. But Jacob Burke was starting in center field over him, and Burke had a really terrible year last year. Can still play the hell out of center field. Like he made some really nice catches look really easy. Like you saw a ball of the gap thing and like that's trouble. And then he's like parking under it. So he's still getting great jumps, taking great lines. You can understand why the White Sox want to see something out of him, or either that or just like having him behind a, you know, a pitching staff they're looking to develop, because he gets a lot of outs that other outfielders might make an adventure of. So, you know, it was interesting seeing Burke there. So I'm curious if it's because they really like the defense and Nishida's defense is more of a project, or if it's a case where like they still believe that Burke might have something to offer after a, you know, really nice 2023 and then just a miserable injury shortened 2024.
Well, for the rest of the minor leagues, the Chicago White Sox, Charlotte, Kyle Teal's cooling off a little bit, slumping. He's 2-for-22 with 10 strikeouts in the last week. However, Edgar Caro's picking it up. He's 6-for-18 at the plate. He just hit his first home run over the weekend. He's got 4 walks to 5 strikeouts. Chase Mydroth is raking in AAA, Jim. 3 home runs. That's a bit of a surprise. Maybe that's the standard Charlotte boost for Mydroth, but he's batting .333. His on base percentage is .500, and he's slugging .750 to start the year. He's got 7 walks to 4 strikeouts, so he's controlling the zone a lot better than he was in spring training. In Winston-Salem, you got Sam Antonacci from Springfield, 5th-round pick in the 2024 draft. He's 4-for-10 for the first weekend with a home run and 5 RBIs. And the other big name in the Garrett Crochet trade, Braden Montgomery for Kannapolis, hit his first home run of the season. Batting right-handed, that's key. A right-handed home run from Braden Montgomery also drove in 7 RBIs in the first three games. So outside of Birmingham, is a lot of attention on Charlotte, Jim, or are there reasons to watch in Kannapolis and Winston-Salem?
Well, Kannapolis has the outfield right now with, you know, Montgomery, Wolkow, and then McLean is also there. And then you have Casey Salke, who's right now DHing.
Is Bonnemer there?
Yes.
Is Caleb Bonnemer
there? So they have the position players. They have the young position players or guys like, you know, McLean, who didn't play last year, who are getting their professional debuts. Montgomery, the same thing. So, I mean, they have the – it's kind of like alternates back and forth between, like, which team has the offense and which team is the pitching. In this case, like, you know, Kannapolis, a little lighter on pitching because they didn't have, like, the college picks you normally see on the second day of the draft to help fill out a low A rotation that can advance to high A within like a month or two. So they look like a little bit underarmed, but the lineup is pretty full. Like when I write out the minor keys, a lot of bullet points for Kannapolis in terms of everybody's worth relaying right now because their professional body, you know, they were drafted high enough or had like enough prospect heat, but also do not have any kind of track record to really measure them against. So we're going to watch all these guys day after day. And then, you know, over the course of weeks and months, we'll figure out if there's anything there.
Well, that will do it for this minor league report. Jim, I'm glad you're able to get down to Birmingham. Great stuff, as always, covering what was happening down in Birmingham. And yeah, we'll have to get you back on to, unfortunately, talk about the Chicago White Sox. But at least for a weekend, you got a reprieve, and you didn't have to see what was going on in Detroit.
Poor James. Poor James.
That will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you just discovered the Sox Machine Podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Apple Podcasts and Spotify. If you sign up to become a Sox Machine subscriber, you can get an ad-free version of the show. Just go into your account settings on SoxMachine.com, copy and paste your private RSS podcast feed, and you can plug it into any podcast player with the exception of Spotify. Spotify does not allow you to manually add RSS feeds into the player. So if you are an Android user, there's a lot of podcast player options out there for you. For those that have iDevices, the iPhones and the iPads, you can manually add that RSS feed into Apple Podcasts. You can also listen and watch this show on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. Follow us on social media or on all the platforms at Sox Machine. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. You can follow James at JR Fegan. Speaking of Sox Machine subscribers, again, once again, huge thank you to everyone that supports us at SoxMachine.com to be able to send James Fegan and Jim Margulis on the road. If you want to unlock full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox and Major League Baseball and even the Major League Baseball draft, go to SoxMachine.com to sign up today. Monthly plans start at $5. We have annual discounts. You can also get subscriptions now, all on our website, SoxMachine.com. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com, your home for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis and James Fegan, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.